There are a lot of quarterbacks in the NFL draft this year. My name is Danny Kelly, and I host the Ringer NFL Draft Show with Danny Heifetz, Ben Solak, and Craig Vorlbeck. We cover trades, free agency, and the draft, obviously. We'll tell you about everything, including which quarterbacks are good, which quarterbacks are not as good, and which quarterbacks are just Kirk Cousins. Search the Ringer NFL Draft Show on Spotify.
It's Off the Pike, presented by FanDuel. The road to the NBA Finals starts now, and FanDuel is the best place to get in on the action. Right now, you can check out the new and improved Quick Bets, which are back and better than ever for the NBA playoffs on FanDuel. Find what you're looking for faster and easier with more props right at your fingertips. You can check out live bets like three-minute markets and exclusive live bets like quarter player props, player assist combos, and more. So download the app today and bet with FanDuel, official partner of the NBA. The Ringer is committed to responsible gaming. Please visit rg-help.com to learn more about the resources and helplines available, and listen to the end of this episode for additional details. Must be 21 plus, 18 plus in DC and present in select states. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or visit rg-help.com.
This episode is brought to you by Vuori. I love sports. I know you do too. I also know that lots of you exercise, but if you're like me and my wife, the beloved sports gal, you're sick and tired of ugly, uncomfortable workout gear, especially, you know, I do a lot of walking. I walk around LA. I make calls. I listen to podcasts. Here are two words that will change everything. Vuori clothing, a line of activewear that is unbelievable. The best thing about Vuori is you can lounge around in it. You can work out in it. You can go outside. You can go shopping down in your local, wherever. And you never feel like you're either underdressed or overdressed. You're just comfortable. You can wear it when you're training, traveling, lounging around the house. Go get yourself some of the most comfortable and versatile clothing on the planet. Here's the deal. Our listeners get 20% off their first purchase at Vuori.com/Simmons. Once again, Vuori.com/Simmons.
Welcome into Off the Pike. I'm Brian Barrett. Special pod tonight because we had the Celtics playing, we had the Bruins playing, and we also had the rest of the NFL draft. So a lot of fun watching the draft, watching the Celtics, the Bruins playoffs all over the place. Just a really nice Saturday. So we figured, you know what, we're going to change up the schedule. We're recording after these games. So let's start with the Celtics. They restore order. They beat the Heat in Miami. It felt different for the Celtics from the jump. The defensive intensity was dialed up in the first quarter where it wasn't there previously, right? The Heat could not score at all in the first quarter. And what is, it wasn't just the Heat were not hitting shots. The Celtics were applying more pressure than they had been in the previous game. And they were actually getting out to shooters. They weren't giving up wide open threes like we talked about the other day. That was such an issue for the Celtics. When this team hit 23, they had so many open opportunities. The Celtics were much better in terms of that. And even if you look at the first half numbers, right? If you look at the amount of threes they took in game two, they got 43 up. And the Celtics lead the NBA at 42.5. In this game, the Heat only got up 28 threes. Denver's last in attempts at 31.2. The Heat have got to be able to get up a ton of threes to be able to beat this Celtics team. They don't have an efficient enough offense to beat this team in the half court. Like, the reason Denver can be the lowest three-point volume team in the NBA is they have the best player in the sport that makes all the right decisions in Nikola Jokic. The Heat don't have that type of player, right? They are going to need to have underdog strategies like taking a bunch of threes. The Celtics did an outstanding job just cutting that off and not allowing them to get up a ton of threes. They held the Heat to 12 points in that first quarter on 24 possessions. That's a 50 offensive rating. Now, I know you can look at it and say, okay, yeah, some of it, they'll shoot the ball a little bit better, but the biggest takeaway I had is the Celtics are actually ready to go from a defensive perspective, and the Celtics offense, let's be real, it wasn't good in the first quarter. It really wasn't great in this game outside of that barrage they had in the second quarter. Celtics in the first quarter have a 91.3 offensive rating, and they're still winning relatively comfortable after that first quarter because of the defense. So that was the first thing that jumped off the screen to me, is the Celtics, they were not going to allow this team to just get up a million wide open threes. They did a much better job closing out to shooters. And they were just more focused. Bottom line, no way around it. They were more focused to start this game than they were in the previous game. And the Celtics themselves, they didn't even shoot the ball well in this game. The Celtics were 11 of 37 from deep. That's 29.7%. The Celtics this season, when they hit 11 threes or fewer, they were just 3-6. So they found a way to win despite the fact that their offense, quite frankly, was not great in this game. The reason they won the game is because they brought the necessary defensive intensity in the first quarter, in the second quarter of this game. They let it off the gas a little bit in the third quarter, but then they dialed it back up. That's why they won, because their defensive effort was much better in this game. Because you look at this, the Celtics, they put up the 42 points in that second quarter, but they had some bad quarters. 21 in the first, as we mentioned. And then in the fourth quarter, 89.5. So they had some bad offensive ratings in this game, and they're still ending up with a 122.4 offensive rating for the game, which would be the best in the NBA. The reason they do that is because they have that monstrous second quarter where they have a 182.6 offensive rating. So that's a big thing to me. The defense was really good, and the Celtics, essentially all they had to do in this game, throw one haymaker in the second quarter, have one quarter of really good offensive basketball, and you win this game comfortably, right? Because the Heat are not going to be able to match you offensively if you're on your game, and the Celtics only really needed their top-tier offensive game for one quarter in this game. And I do think there's still a lot of things the Celtics can do better offensively, and we'll get into those here, because the biggest difference maker to me from a player perspective was Derek White, where he didn't score in the first quarter, and then he took over the second quarter where he had 12 points. He hits a top of the key three. He had the putback on the offensive rebound, made it 52-31. Those are the energy plays that Derek White makes for this team, right? Then he hit another top of the key three, and then he had a tip-in on a Tatum miss. So he had two tip-ins during that session. Like, he was, or that quarter, I should say. He was just crashing the glass, hitting open shots, and he was controlling the ball more, right? Where, and that is something that I called for after game two. The Celtics were so flummoxed by the matchup, the fact that he had a good defender on him in Caleb Martin, or good for the Heat, I should say, Caleb Martin on him, rather than Hero. The Celtics are like, okay, let's just play through Jaylen because he has this mismatch. And Derek White wasn't really heavily involved in the game. And what we saw in this one is they said, okay, it doesn't matter if he has a good defender on him. He's going to make good decisions. Let's get him the basketball more. And I thought he was outstanding in this game. And then in the third quarter, where the Heat, they were trying to make a run, not that you were ever threatened, but pushes the ball, gets Jaylen a layup, makes it 74-53. Drives by Martin and finishes. Jumper over Jovic, right? He just made the necessary plays when he needed to in that third quarter as well. So he finishes with 16, 5 rebounds, and 3 assists. And I just feel, I don't know about you, but when I'm watching the game and Derek White has the ball and he's handling the ball and he's at the controls, I feel like the Celtics are going to get a good shot, okay? They may not hit all the shots, but I feel like a good decision is going to be made. And Tatum's been really good in this series. We'll get into him in a second here. But I really don't have that feeling about anybody else besides Derek White. I do sort of with Tatum that they could get a good shot, but I just feel like Derek White, that's when I'm at my most comfortable watching the Celtics, when Derek White is at the helm and he's making the decision. So I was glad they played through Derek White more in this game, despite the fact that those defensive matchups really sort of fucked with the Celtics for a little bit. So that was good to see. With Porzingis, obviously had his worst game as a Celtic in that game two loss. He finishes with 18 points. It was kind of a mixed bag for me because I thought he started off the game really well. He hit the top of the key three to make it 3-0. But then Bam comes right back on him, scores on him, makes it 3-3. Now, one thing I will say is I was surprised. I can't remember if I talked about this on the pod or somewhere else, that they started the game with Porzingis on Bam. I thought they'd maybe throw Tatum or Jaylen on Bam. Now, Bam, later in this game, Porzingis had back-to-back really good contests on him, so maybe that's something to build off. I just think Bam's a tough matchup for Porzingis because of the speed element that Bam brings, but one time on the contested in the third quarter there, Bam actually bullied him underneath the hoop, but because of Porzingis' outstanding length, he was still able to alter the shot, and then he forced Bam into a turnaround that had no shot at going in. So that was a good sign in terms of covering Bam. I just think that's a tough matchup. But we're now three games into this thing, and the Celtics are up 2-1. I don't expect any dramatic changes there. I think they're going to keep rolling with Porzingis on Bam. Okay, then he got an alley-oop early in this game. Made it 5-3, hit another three. I loved the offensive rebound and finish that made it 43-28. You love to see that. Got to the free throw line on a Jovic foul. And then the one thing I will say, though, is I do think there is a little bit too much Porzingis getting the ball at the free throw line. And I know it's worked throughout the season. I don't feel like that's a great spot for him. And the thing that he does when he gets the ball at the free throw line, he goes too slow. So during the regular season, it works because you don't have defenders that are completely dialed in. With this Heat team, the way they play is they're sort of baiting Porzingis, and then a help defender will come over and affect Porzingis in some way. So I just don't love that. I feel like there's much better things that the Celtics can get to offensively than giving the ball to Porzingis at the free throw. And now, when they're in the zone, I'm totally cool with it. But not when they're in their man-to-man, their switching scheme. I just don't think that's something the Celtics should be going to. If you want to do it on the block, fine. I just don't like them going to him there at the free throw line. I just feel like even the shots that he hits, they're not great shots. So I just, that's one thing that I would look for going forward is get away from Porzingis at the free throw line. One other guy I thought was awesome, I mentioned Derek White. I loved what Pritchard did in this game. And how many times have we said throughout the season, when he comes into the game, he changes the way the game is being played. He plays faster. He gets on the offensive glass. And it was like he was a shot out of a cannon in this game. He had a three right away, made it 17-8. He drove it. He finished around Caleb Martin, which is an outstanding finish to make it 35-16. He had an offensive rebound and a finish right after that to make it 37-19. So this was a really good Pritchard game. And one thing I'm just wondering about here is he played 10 less minutes than Drew Holiday. I get it. Drew just got the extension, but Drew Holiday is not exactly a young player anymore. And he just took some absolutely atrocious shots in this game. Look, I don't want to nitpick because the Celtics won. I'm happy that they're up 2-1 of the series, but he took two pull-up wing threes with no pass in the possession. Like, dude, what are you doing? Like, it's just a terrible shot. And then he took that one where he had Patty Mills on him. It was a turnaround shot over the backboard. And I know you look at Dre, the best plus minus on the team in this game. But I just feel like Pritchard could be playing more minutes in the series. I feel like he's really impacting things, especially on the offensive end. And there's not like matchups you're scared about on the other end that maybe Pritchard could get exposed from a hype perspective. And he's been good in this series defensively. So I just think that those numbers in terms of the minutes can be closer between Drew and Peyton Pritchard. I want to see more Peyton Pritchard. Okay, really good Tatum game, 22, 11-6. He got to the free throw line 12 times. I thought one of the three point one that he got to there, I thought that was a bullshit foul call. But nonetheless, I mean, he got there and they were calling it, so give him credit for that. One interesting thing, though, is he missed four free throws. He's now missed six in the last two games. He's shooting 78.6% from the free throw line in this series. Jaylen is 5-for-11 from the free throw line in the series. He only took one today, but this is sort of a weird development. Not that Jaylen's missing free throws, but that Tatum is. Jaylen has had one of his worst free throw shooting seasons, and we've seen Jaylen a bunch of times in the clutch miss free throws. But if you look at this right now, the Celtics in this series are 44-of-58 from the free throw line, 75.8%. That's atrocious. Only three teams were south of that this season. The Celtics were 80.7%, seventh best in the NBA. So I don't know what's going on at the free throw line with Tatum. That's just an interesting thing to sort of monitor going forward. Oh, I should mention this. I don't understand this, and I brought this up before. When Derek White's on the floor, why doesn't he shoot the tee? Now, Tatum hit the tee, but Derek White was eighth in the NBA this season in free throw shooting. He's over 90%. Tatum's a good free throw shooter on the season, even though he hasn't been good in the series. He's at, I believe, 83%. But why isn't your best free throw shooter taking the free throws? I don't understand this. I guess it's a status thing, but it doesn't make any sense to me. You got the eighth best free throw shooter in the league. Let him take the damn free throw. I don't know. It's bizarre to me. But anyway, I think one thing that I noticed about Tatum, and this is in games 1, 2, and 3, he's very comfortable in this matchup. And I know Jimmy Butler's not playing. We can say all that. By the way, great job by the TNT broadcast saying today that Jimmy Butler's a big loss. You think, guys? Thanks, man. I really appreciate you guys analyzing that. But nonetheless, Tatum is just, in the past years against Miami, he hasn't always been comfortable. And he's really calm, and he's making the right decisions in this series. And you can go through some of the plays that he had in this game, had the fadeaway over Hawkes, and you can say, well, that's a tough shot. Yeah, but Hawkes was covering Tatum, and Tatum was sort of near the baseline. Tatum saw the double coming, so he spun towards the baseline, hit a nice little jumper on him, taking on the extra defender, hit a three ball at the top of the key, and then he got an ISO on Martin, and he didn't just try to take a step back three. He got him into the mid-range area, buried a jumper over him. And then he had this outstanding left-handed whip pass to Sam Hauser for a layup to make it 41-23. That was a great pass by Tatum. He does not make that pass last season. That's an outstanding pass. So he finishes the first half 15-6-4. As for Jalen, so by the way, Tatum, I think he's been really, really good in the series. Jalen finishes with 22. He's 0-4 from deep. He did have 8 rebounds. He did have 3 assists. Mixed bag to me with Jalen. It's just a weird situation because of the hero matchup, right? I was really worried early on in this game that, oh shit, they're doing the same thing they did last game. It's going to be, hey, Jalen's just going to try to ISO up hero throughout this game. And if you look at it, he took 6 of the first 11 shots. He took 9 of the first 18. And eventually I felt like he got it going when he did have the offensive rebound, the follow dunk. Mazzulla talked about that after the game. He really liked it. Had a nice pull-up mid-ranger over Jovic. Then he ISO'd Bam and he missed a tough shot. He took some bad shots early on in this game. And I know he can hit those. Like, he had the spin that he tried to hit one over. I forget who was defending him at the time, but he tried to hit like a mid-ranger falling away. And Jalen's really good at those shots. It's just, I think he's settling for those. And then we saw, like, when the offense got going, drove by hero, easy bucket. Okay. And then the energy on the other end. Remember, he blocked Hawkes on a 3. Then he has a backdoor cut on the other end and gets a dunk to make it 70-43. And then he drove and got a floater to make it 72-48. So when he's getting downhill in this matchup, that's what you want. What the Heat want him to do is play that slow, methodical style where he's just sort of sizing up hero and he takes a bad shot. What he's going to do is just get the ball, be decisive, and go get downhill. And I know he can hit those mid-rangers, right? 89th percentile via cleaning the glass this year on mid-rangers, 48%. But it's just, to me, it's better if he's getting towards the basket, getting downhill, because that's how you exploit that matchup. If you're taking tough fadeaways over Tyler Hero, you're not exploiting the matchup, right? Even if you hit those. I mean, that's not great offense. When you have a weak defender like Hero, you need to be attacking. So that's the one thing I hope is he found that a bit in the second quarter and into the second half. I hope we see more of that going forward, because it's just, it's been weird. The Celtics have been flummoxed by that matchup. Okay. The other thing you give the Celtics for in this game is they got to the offensive boards. They finished with 10 in the game, but 8 of those came in the first half. And they had just 6 total offensive rebounds in game 2. You need to create extra opportunities, especially when you take a lot of threes. And you look at that first game, game 2, when they only had the 6. The Lakers are last in the NBA at 8.2. So you were worse than the worst offensive rebounding team of the NBA. The Celtics have been above average in that category. A lot has to do with Cornette, who we saw get some burn today, but Pritchard's been an outstanding offensive rebounder for them this year as well. Celtics are at 10.7, 14th. Knicks lead the league at 12.7. First half, you have 8. You finish with 10, but in the first half, you got yourself extra opportunities, and a lot of those you're getting dunks on. So that was big to me, is you're going to have to find a way to create more opportunities. So I do think that this offense has to be better. It can be better. We saw signs of it, but we didn't see that consistency that we saw in game 1 of the series. I thought it was pretty funny in the post-game press conference. I don't know who the reporter was, but the reporter said, "Coach, they say there are 4 guarantees in the world: life, death, taxes, and a spicy series between the Celtics and the Heat in the playoffs." First of all, nobody says that. Secondarily, this guy thought it was going to be hilarious. Nobody in the room laughed, including Mazzulla, who he's asking the question to. The guy went on and asked him a question after that. It's just, I don't understand why you're trying to be funny there. It's just, it was embarrassing for the reporter, quite frankly. Stan Van Gundy on this broadcast, we mentioned the Jimmy Butler thing. He also mentioned that the Celtics have a really good defense like 30 times. Everybody knows this, man. Like, he's pointing out, well, nobody talks about the defense. The number 2 defense in the league. Okay, man, like, we get it. They have a good defense. The other thing, at the end of the game, he's trying to make this point about how the top 3 seeds in the West all have big leads in their series. And by the time you listen to this, we may have the result on the Lakers Nuggets. Like, the Lakers could be eliminated by the time you listen to this, or it could be a 3-1 series. But the point being is that he said a lot of people thought the Lakers are going to make this a tough series against Denver. I would say to Stan Van Gundy, who said that? Most people, like, the biggest thing about that series is people are saying before it, they should duck them and lose the play-in game so they play OKC. I don't remember a lot of people saying, oh, the Lakers are going to give the Nuggets a series. So I thought that was bizarre. I had a straw man argument. I don't know who he's arguing with. I do need to address the hero situation. I can't stand this guy. He throws the ball at Hauser after a foul where Hauser kind of tripped him. And it's not like he threw it hard at him, but he's talking shit. And then he's getting into it with Pritchard. He's telling him to meet him in the back. It's like, dude, if Bam's doing that, if Jimmy Butler was playing and he was doing that, like, okay, we take that seriously. But what are you going to do? Tyler Hero? I mean, come on. He's acting like he's a tough guy. It's ridiculous to me. Mazzulla, I thought some interesting things with him in this game. Where there's 3 minutes left in the first quarter, you get the timeout, comes out of the timeout, puts a press on, and they get a turnover. It eventually leads to a Pritchard three. They make it 17-8 there. So it's just a nice wrinkle where Miami was not expecting that. They didn't expect the Celtics to press, and we saw that a couple of times out of timeouts, and they were able to catch Miami off guard doing that. So I love that. And then the other thing I liked is when it was 14-9 to start that third quarter from the Heat, he called the timeout right then and there. And remember, so many times in the past, people have criticized his timeout usage for not stopping runs. He did it right there. So I did appreciate that. I do think overall this is a good test for the Celtics because, as I mentioned, there's still a lot of issues that I have with the series, but they're up 2-1. They're playing against the best coach team in the NBA. Like, they're not going to have another matchup in this postseason where the coach is better. That team is trying different strategies, weird strategies. So I do think this series is going to get the Celtics ready for the rest of the postseason because I told you that I thought this would be a convincing win. The big test is going to be Monday. How do you respond when the Heat are coming off the loss? They're the more desperate team. How are you going to react? Because game two, you didn't react with the same desperation. So I'm really interested to see the effort that the Celtics provide on Monday night. I think that's going to tell us a lot about this team going forward. You had the one hiccup. Avoid the second. All right, let's get to the Bees because they take a 3-1 series lead over the Leafs. Another win in Toronto. It is very satisfying from a Bruins perspective, a Bruins fans perspective, I should say, in the third period, or rather in the second period, the boos are raining down on the Leafs. This team just cannot get out of its own way. Whatever it is, every year the Leafs find a way to just not come through in the postseason. And it appears they're on their way to doing it again. Now, I will say this. We all know what happened last year with the Bees and the Panthers. They were up 3-1. The Panthers come all the way back in that particular series. This team doesn't feel like the same team that the Panthers were a year ago. That Panthers team, of course, made it all the way to the Stanley Cup Final. It doesn't seem like that team. Not to mention the fact that this Toronto team, really, they can't catch breaks either. Nylander was injured for the first three games. He's back on the ice tonight. And then you see, of course, Austin Matthews doesn't play in the entire third period. And Matthews is dealing with some sort of an illness. He has not been practicing, has not been at morning skates, all that stuff, because he's been dealing with an illness. He's not even out there for the third period. So it just feels like if the Leafs are going to crawl out of this hole, it would be. And look, anytime you come back from a 3-1 series lead, it's shocking. But this would be absolutely shocking. Shocking, shocking, shocking if they could somehow dig out of this hole based on. The Bruins are outplaying them right now. The Bruins obviously have the advantage from a goaltender perspective. We'll get into that in a second here. The Leafs, of course, made a change to start that third period. It just feels like the Bees have all the momentum, and they just took two on Toronto's home ice. So I just think early on in this game, you felt like the Bees are going to win with the way that they came out and they played. I mean, they killed off that penalty early on in the game, right? I mean, it's very early on. It's like, less than 4 minutes into the game, they have to kill off a penalty, and they spent 20 seconds in the Leafs zone when the Leafs are the team on the power play, right? And then after that, I feel like one of the guys we have to point out in this game is Mason Lorai, because I told you, I thought in game three, he was horrible, right? And on that JVR goal, the Van Riemsdyk goal, he's the one that keeps that puck in the zone. Boom, Van Riemsdyk beats, at the time, Samsonov, five-hole, outstanding play by Lorai there, especially considering that he was so bad in the last game. A little bit of experience, get your first playoff game under you. He looked much more comfortable in this game. So I thought the Bruins were the much better team if you look at the first period of this game. And then into the second period, they just continue that. Because you got the power play goal for Marchand, which, by the way, that was just such a dumb penalty. Unbelievably dumb penalty by Domi. It's a clear cross-check on Pastrnak, and this is sort of what we've been talking about with this Leafs team. They're just dumb. Going back to game one, what was Domi doing at the beginning of the game to Marchand, trying to get him to essentially fight him at the beginning of the game? It was just bizarre. The Leafs have just, they've played really strange in this series. Some of the stuff they do is just, that's just dumb. Why would you put this Bruins team on the power play that they were bad down the stretch of the season in terms of the power play? They figured it out in the final game where they put Shattenkirk out there. And ever since then, the Bruins have been good on the power play, especially in the series. And Domi just gift wraps them a power play opportunity. And McAvoy with the feed to Marchand. Marchand buries it. By the way, beautiful pass, Coyle to McAvoy to eventually set up Marchand. A great job by McAvoy to sell it where he got Samsonov on the ground. So that was outstanding play all the way around. But Toronto did that to themselves because they took a dumb penalty. And Marchand right now, unbelievable in the series. He is absolutely on fire. So after tonight, he now has 3 goals in the series. He has 8 points. The only player in the postseason right now that has more points than Brad Marchand is this guy by the name of Connor McDavid. May have heard of him. He's pretty good at hockey. He has 9 points in the series against the Kings. So other than that, it's the only guy that has more points in the postseason so far than what Brad Marchand's been able to do. And then, of course, you get the third goal, the second goal of the second period, third goal in the game, where outstanding play by Zacha to sort of chip that puck ahead while he's getting hit. Marchand kicks it to himself and finds Pasta for the goal. And by the way, before that, when Marchand actually beat Brody the puck, I don't know what Brody was thinking there. He just sort of tried to poke it. I mean, that's definitely a risk that wasn't worth taking at that point in time. And Marchand sets up Pasta, and that's where we started to hear the boos. Now, I will say this, in the third period, clearly the Leafs did look like a desperate team because, I mean, quite frankly, they were. They entered the third period down 3-0, and in the series, they're down 2-1. So there's going to be some desperation there. They don't have Matthews. In a weird way, I almost felt like that sort of helped them because they did pick up the intensity. Maybe it's knowing, like, hey, we got to be a lot better because we don't have our best player. And they also, they benched Samsonov for Joseph Woll, which I would expect that we see Woll to start the next game. They were looking for some sort of a spark, and Samsonov has not been good in the series, so I expect we do see a change there that Woll gets the net in game 5 of the series. Now, no Matthews, of course, and this is something to monitor because they say he's dealing with some sort of an illness, but if you look at it throughout, and it makes sense because you look at the series, game 1 he has 5 shots, game 2, the game where he's the best player on the ice, he has 8 shots, he had 3 points in that game. Then game 3 wasn't himself either, had just the 3 shots, and he didn't look right. And as we're finding out, he's not practicing, not going to morning skate, that type of stuff, dealing with this, whatever this illness is. And then he has just 1 shot in the 2 periods in this game. So if you look at it, he only has a point in 1 game. All his points of the series came in that game 2. Games 3 and 4 in Toronto, he wasn't good, but clearly a lot of it has to do with a health situation. He's been getting maintenance days, and this is after, as we alluded to earlier, they haven't really had Nylander in the series until tonight because he was dealing with an injury. He had been dealing with migraines. So the Bruins, look, and they were going to win this game whether Austin Matthews played or not in the third period. I mean, it was pretty clear. The Bruins completely controlled this game really from start to finish outside a little bit of pressure that the Leafs put on the Bees there in that third period. But all in all, I mean, a dominant performance by the Bees. The one goal, I mean, not on Swayman. It's Marner gets to his backhand and he beats him there. But the other thing I would say is Swayman had that outstanding save right after that on Nylander. Unbelievable save on Nylander there, where Nylander point blank tried to do something similar to what Marner did, wasn't really able to elevate the puck. And then at the end of the period, or close to the end of the period, about 5 minutes left in the game, around there, 5:20 left in the game, Toronto's got a chance to make it a 3-2 game, rather, because you have the slashing penalty on Pastrnak, which, kind of soft, but anyway, not on Pasta, on the officiating. They don't even get a shot on net. They did have a chance there, but they didn't have a shot on net in that entire power play. So I don't even really think there's anything the Leafs can take from this and say, hey, we feel good about this heading back to Boston. They really don't have anything to feel good about right now. And I will say some other good Bruins news, if you look at what's going on in the Atlantic Division right now, is the Panthers are getting pushed because it felt like, hey, maybe the Panthers end this series and the Lightning end up getting a win. So it's at least going to go 5. We know the Bruins, of course, this is at least going 5, hopefully not going to 6. But the Panthers now, they have to play an extra game against Tampa because they couldn't finish that off. Tampa wins that game 6-3 on Saturday afternoon. So we'll see what happens going forward in the series in terms of can the Bruins close it out. My prediction will be they will, especially considering the fact that We saw what happened last year when this team blew the 3-1 lead. I think they're going to come out like crazy. I think the Garden is going to be bumping, and this team is going to get it done. They don't want to mess around. Last year was just an incredible, stressful series. I bet that you see this team play really well. I think that you'll see a similar effort to what we saw in this game tonight where the Bruins come out and they're on fire. But I really can't believe, no, I shouldn't say I can't believe, but it's impressive how well Marchand has been playing in this postseason. Because he had a good regular season, but it wasn't like an unbelievable season for Marchand. He has been absolutely tremendous ever since the playoffs started. DeBrusk has been good. Lauri, to me tonight, that was the most surprising thing. And now the decision comes down to Swayman, because this is the first time that the Bruins have decided, hey, let's ride with Swayman, where he plays in the consecutive games. They don't go to the goalie rotation. And 25 saves in this one. He was awesome the other night as well. And I know that Jim Montgomery keeps talking about they're sticking to the goalie rotation. I just don't see them doing it now. They already went away from it in this game. I can't comprehend that they would put Ullmark in the net. And by the way, I want to be crystal clear about this. I think I said this after game two, but they didn't lose that game because of Ullmark. Ullmark was fine in that game. I mean, the one, maybe he could have made the save on the Matthews breakaway where he bit too hard when he went to his backhand when he's going to get back to, he didn't have to bite as hard as he did, but it's Austin Matthews. He's the best goal scorer in the NHL, right? He has a nice amount of goals. So that's going to happen from time to time. And I wouldn't say there's anything that says, hey, I wouldn't have faith if you put Ullmark back in. It's just Swayman's playing awesome right now. He's been unbelievable in this postseason run. I do think that a large part of why he's been awesome is what Montgomery said after game one, is he finally got an opportunity to start the series. That hasn't happened for him in his career, right? He's always been the guy that they go to after Ullmark. And in this series, he got the opportunity to start. And I think that built up confidence in him. And now he has 3 wins in the series. I would just continue to ride Swayman going forward. All right, a lot more to get into coming up next. We'll get into the draft because the Patriots were busy. And I like what Elliot Wolf did. The road to the NBA Finals starts now. And new customers on FanDuel can go on their own playoff run with $150. Just place any $5 bet and you'll get $150 in bonus bets, win or lose, to use during the NBA playoffs. All right, now I'm looking at this Philly-Knicks game. Game 4 coming up in Philadelphia early Sunday afternoon. I like the Sixers to tie this series up. The line's 4.5, so how about instead of just taking them on the line, take them on the money line and parlay that with Tyrese Maxey over 25.5 points. You can get that at plus 135. Maxey had 25 in the last game. And he had 25 with like 10 minutes left of the fourth quarter. Easily could have gone over that. They really do not have a good matchup for Maxey. So I like Maxey over the 25.5 and Philly to tie this series up 2-2. And FanDuel is now live in our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Just go to FanDuel.com/Pike to get started. FanDuel, official sports betting partner of the NBA. Must be 21+, 18+ in D.C. and present in select states. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or visit rg-help.com. First online real money wager only. $10 first deposit required. Bonus issued as non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire 7 days after receipt. Restrictions apply. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Welcome back into Off the Pike. So I did want to get to the Pats, of course, because the draft wrapped up on Saturday afternoon, which was good for us because then we could just worry about the Celtics and the Bruins at night. But the one thing I took away from the draft is Elliot Wolf had a clear plan where they didn't get the receiver they wanted in free agency, but they put resources into that position in the draft. So I really like a lot of what Elliot Wolf did in this draft. Now, there are some issues that, of course, I had with some of the selections, and we'll get into that. But I do like the fact that we all know how I feel about Drake May, and most of you already have your opinions on Drake May. We went over that the other day. But you want to do everything you possibly can to help the quarterback. And looking at the roster now compared to looking at the roster 3 days ago, you look a lot better in terms of helping out a young quarterback. So I love the fact that they put the resources into the receiver position in this draft, right? Where we've seen what not having the proper weapons, and look, there's no guarantees with any of these guys, but at least there was an effort to do it, right? Where it felt like at times the Patriots didn't, and look, the answer was Mac Jones is just never going to be good enough, but the Patriots at times, they didn't do enough for a young quarterback, especially a guy like Mac, that isn't insanely talented like Drake May, but you still need to help the quarterback. So let me get to the picks here. So Jalen Polk did surprise me, okay? And the main reason I say that is Ladd McConkey was on the board. So I was shocked that McConkey was on the board as well. I said the other day when we were doing the pod with Fitzy, I'm assuming he's off the board in the first round. But apparently the medical issues were a bigger concern for teams than maybe we were hearing as we were leading up to the draft, right? So bunch of injuries at the collegiate level, including a back thing. So if the Patriots, one of the teams that looked at it and said, hey, we just don't trust the health of him going forward, totally understand why you wouldn't take Ladd McConkey, right? On top of the back, too, you had turf toe, you had knee tendonitis, just a lot of stuff for McConkey. So I'm sure the back thing played into this with the Patriots like it did for a lot of other teams. So it also surprised me, as I alluded to, that you took Polk. The reason for this is who I really do like, and I'll explain why in a second here. But the one thing that surprised me about that pick, where they took him at 37, is the upside, right? Where he doesn't have some of the upside, or doesn't have the upside that some of these other receivers have that went after him, quite frankly. So, for example, you look at A.D. Mitchell out of Texas. You look at Troy Franklin out of Oregon, who I told you the other day I really liked Franklin, and he really dropped, man. He went, what, 102nd? Mitchell went 52nd. Those guys did have super high upsides, right? Where you look at it and you say, Mitchell was a freak show at the combine, ran a 4.34, 94th percentile. Vert was in the 89th percentile. We told you Troy Franklin has speed too. Polk is not a burner, just in the 43rd percentile in terms of his 40, 4.52. So he did test out well in terms of the broad 88th percentile, but not like an unbelievable athlete for the position, right? We see all these freak athletes at the receiver position. He's not that. But so that's my one gripe here is you're at 34, then down to 37. And look, maybe I'll be wrong or this, but he probably projects as like a number two receiver, which I'm fine with that. I'm just saying that it surprised me at the time that they took Polk, even though I like the player. They probably could have even moved further down if they wanted to. Now, Elliott Wolf did say that he would have taken him at 34, but maybe at that point you're like, hey, if we have such a high grade on the player, maybe somebody else does too, so they're afraid of losing their guy. Totally understand that. I just point out the fact that this is more of a nice double, right? It's not going to be a home run, but it could be a really nice double, and it could be a really valuable player going forward for this organization. And the reporting around Polk is he's one of the most NFL-ready guys right now, okay? Not talking about like the top tier guys, right? Like Marvin Harrison, Neighbors. We're talking about like the other group of receivers. A lot of people consider Polk one of the most ready to go right now. So that's part of what I really do like about this pick. And so you look at it too. One other thing that sticks out to me about this is the burner thing is not important to Elliott Wolf. And I get he didn't make all these picks, but second round receivers, they were really good in Green Bay when he was there. Davante Adams was a second rounder. He ran a 4.56, 40th percentile. Jordy Nelson ran a 4.51, 51st percentile. So I don't think they even care about the 40 with Polk. I'm just pointing it out. And I know that he didn't make all the picks there, but he was heavily involved in the personnel stuff. And I think with Polk, I'm not saying he's automatically going to be Jordy Nelson or Davante Adams, right? I told you that the most likely scenario is he's an incredible number two at the NFL level. Like, that's the most likely scenario, is he's a legit number two, not a number one, right? But to me, and I know maybe I'll regret saying this because it's the NFL draft, this feels like almost a really, really safe pick. And that's important, right? You need guys that are safe picks that you feel like, yes, we know exactly what this guy's going to do at the NFL level, and he's going to do exactly what we ask him to do at a very high level, right? And if you watched Washington this past season, I'm sure a lot of you saw the Texas game. He went nuts, 5 for 122 in that playoff game with a touchdown. The first Oregon game, huge game. Remember, those two teams were undefeated at the time. He goes for 6 for 118. Like, this guy is a very talented player. He's tough. He can go up. He can make contested catches. And he plays with a ton of fire. The reality of the situation is this. I know he played with a guy that was up for the Heisman, and Michael Penix Jr., who went to Atlanta. We talked about that the other night. He had 7 100-yard games this past season. The guy flat out was productive at the collegiate level. That, and it's not like he's playing in a terrible conference. He's playing in the Pac-12. Them and Oregon, really good teams, right? And Danny Kelly made the comp on his draft guide to Jacoby Myers. I think he's more athletic than Jacoby Myers, but Jacoby Myers is a really, really good player, right? He's a really productive player. This past season, he had 50 yards per game, and he had 8 touchdowns. We all saw him in a Patriots uniform. How many times this season did we talk about the fact that the Patriots were missing Jacoby Myers? Why do you have Juju and not Jacoby, right? We talked about that time and time again. And Jacoby Myers is a very quarterback-friendly receiver who runs really good routes. So I think what Polk is, he's an even more athletic version than Jacoby Myers is. And basically the idea is this. And as I said, nothing is guaranteed. But you basically, to me, okay, this is me. This is my prediction here. I think you pretty much secured a productive receiver on your team next season. I would not be shocked at all if he has the second most receiving yards on the team next season behind Kendrick Bourne. And quite frankly, if Bourne's dealing with some sort of, we'll see, like the knee situation. I know we talked to Callahan. He thinks that he's going to be ready to go right away, like coming back from the ACL. It was a clean tear of the ACL. But let's say something hypothetically, like Bourne misses some time. Polk could easily be the guy that leads his team in receiving. That's how confident I am in what he does at the collegiate level, translating to the NFL, okay? Sure, he doesn't have the upside that a lot of these other receivers have, and we talked about that, but this team desperately needs weapons. You need more competent receivers to go with Kendrick Bourne and DeMario Douglas. You don't have anybody else right now that you can depend on in that receiver room besides those two guys. Polk is an important pick for that reason. Hey, we know he's a rookie, but we are very confident he's going to come in from day one, exceptional route runner, fights for the ball, can get down the field. You can put him all over the field in terms of the receiver positions. He is going to be a productive player for us. So I really do like the pick, even though I said I understand and I acknowledge the lack of upside, if you will, with some of the other guys in the class. I love the pick. Sometimes you don't have to hit a home run, right? You got the quarterback. That's a home run pick. So you got to make sure you help the quarterback. This is a great pick for the Patriots, I felt like. And the more and more that if you watch him play, you're going to be impressed with the guy. So I really like that pick. Okay. So the other thing that I would mention too is it's interesting. So we had Doug Kide, who was the first guy that brought this up on the pod, and Fitzy last week. They both brought up Javon Baker, who the Patriots then get in the fourth round. And this makes me like the Polk pick even more, okay? Because Baker does have super high upside. This guy is going to be a legit, like, if he hits, it's going to be really good, right? Like, there is more, way more bust potential, obviously. But he does have a really high upside. Now, like Polk, not an incredible athlete, right? But this is a massive recruit that left Alabama, went to UCF. And what he does, he gets down the field and he makes plays. So these stats are via Pro Football Focus. I take the regular season out of the, I filter out the playoffs and the bowl games because I don't know who's playing all the time in those bowl games, right? So if you look at his numbers during the regular season at UCF, 22.5 yards per reception. 22.5 yards per reception. That was number three in all of college football. He was also 16th in yards per route run, right behind Rome Odunze, who was considered to be one of the top three receivers in the class. So he does have some drop issues, had six drops last year, but that's part of why he's here, right? That's part of why he's further down in the draft where he's falling to the fourth round is because there are some questions. And I look at him too. The yak was really good, 7.4 yards after the catch per reception. He can make guys miss. And if you go watch his highlight tape, you'll see some ridiculous catches. Like he's very cocky too. Like he blew a kiss to the guys on Oklahoma on the sideline when he was running for a touchdown. But he had this great catch against Kansas that it was just stupid. And he beats people down the field. One thing you'll notice too, unbelievable on the sidelines, like always getting his feet down. That's obviously a massive weapon in the NFL when you can do that. But he also said on Saturday when he was getting interviewed by the media, this is a direct quote from him, "Bring your popcorn. I make people in wheelchairs stand up." And he did. Before that, he was doing an IG story. And he said in the IG story, first of all, he said, "Where's the motherfucking liquor at?" I'm not kidding. You can look on this. It's on social media. He said, "Where's the motherfucking liquor at?" And then he also said, "Just got paid. It took too long. You fitting to pay." That's what he said at the end of it. So this guy is obviously incredibly entertaining. I already love him just for the personality. And the one thing you'll notice on the highlights, just watch him near the sideline. I know I referenced that earlier, but his footwork near the sideline, really, really good. So that's why I adore this pick and the combination of those two picks, because the Patriots desperately needed receivers. They got one that's almost a sure thing. I'll look like an idiot if he's not good. But anyway, I believe that. I believe Polk is pretty much a sure thing. And then you got a guy with really, really big upside, right? So I loved it. I loved how Elliot Wolf handled the receiver position. He attacked it. I know that they missed out on Calvin Ridley. I told you on the pod, was not the biggest fan of Calvin Ridley to begin with. Love what they did with the receiver position. I do wonder now, you think about this receiver room, who's going to be on the team, right? Because we know that Pop Douglas and Kendrick Bourne, those are your main two guys. Polk's going to be on the team. Baker's going to be on the team, right? They signed KJ Osborne. Tyquan Thornton, what's he going to be doing for this team? What's his role? Is he still on the team? Kayshon Booty, of course, has had his issues off the field. Juju Smith-Schuster was so bad last year. Do they just, I mean, they're not going to be able to trade him, but they have a lot of bodies, and I just don't know what they're going to do with all those guys. I wouldn't be surprised if Juju, Kayshon Booty, and Tyquan Thornton all aren't on the team, or at least two of those three guys aren't on the team next season. Okay, and I know it's like you pay Juju all this money, but it's a sunk cost at this particular point in time, at least for me. Unless like something happens this offseason and he starts to look like a competent NFL player again. But right now, I'm treating that as like a sunk cost. I don't expect him to do anything next year. Okay, now let's get to some of the more confusing decisions here. So they drafted Kadon Wallace out of Penn State. Wallace was 68th overall. This one to me is a bit perplexing because if you look at it, he had a good career. And Elliot Wolf said he's very versatile. He is a super athlete for the position, 96th percentile in the broad, 81st in the vert, and somebody that they talked about trading back, right? Where Wolf thought maybe they could trade back, but then he says sometimes it doesn't fall for you. It fell pretty nicely for us today. So to me, it's you could have easily traded back there and still gotten the player in all likelihood. But the question I have, it's not so much about Wallace because he may turn out to be a really good Patriot, right? And I'm not going to sit here and pretend like I watched every single snap that Wallace took at the collegiate level. But one of the things is the Patriots needed a left tackle, right? And he played his whole college career on the right side. And Elliot Wolf did say he has the athleticism to switch, but now you're asking a guy that played all his collegiate career on the right side to move to the left side, if you even do that, right? We don't even know if they'll do that, as Elliot Wolf said today. And the Patriots just signed Michael Onwenu to a huge deal in the offseason to play right tackle. So unless this works and he can play left tackle, you're still without a left tackle right now. So look, this is not me taking shots at Wallace. He may turn out to be very productive for this team for a number of years. It's just, to me, the logic here is odd that they took somebody that doesn't play on the left side, and their hope is, hey, he's athletic enough to go over there. So that one was a little strange to me. They did take Layden Robinson from A&M. He is super long arms, even though he's not that big in term. I say he's not that big. He's 6'3 and a half, 302 pounds, but that's not big. It's in the 13th percentile, right? But, and this does seem like Van Pelt was involved in this one, a guy that can pull, right? So the type of guy that they want in that running game that they're going to be incorporating here. 92nd percentile in the broad, 90th in arm length, hand size 86th percentile. So it's an athletic guard. It does make a lot of sense for how the Patriots are going to want to run their offense now that it's a different regime in here. But they did just draft Sidy Sow, and Robinson as a pass blocker did not grade out well, 233rd via PFF. And look, you can see the vision here, right? Like I was alluding to in terms of how they want to run their offense. But I do wonder if this says something about Cole Strange, because remember, he's coming back from injury. He's not been that good as an NFL player, and you just drafted Sidy Sow. But I do wonder if this is something about Cole Strange. So it was just weird that at that time of the draft, they would go that position. But again, I mean, maybe there's something else going on here, and maybe this is just someone, you know, certain guys like in the draft process, this is my guy, right? Maybe Van Pelt really wanted him to be part of that offense that they want to run with the running game. Okay, sixth round. Marcellus Dial from South Carolina, not a huge guy, 56th percentile in height, 5'11", 190, 39th percentile in terms of the weight. Long arms, though, wingspan in the 80th percentile, verts in the 91st, broads in the 87th. He ran a 4.47. He's a man-to-man corner, and you think about the room that they have right now with the Patriots in terms of corner, this is like a sneaky need for the Patriots in this draft, right? When you think about it, because yes, you have Christian Gonzalez, who we all believe is going to be an absolute stud, and That was the best part of the Patriots season at the beginning of the year when he was playing. He was awesome for this team, battling with A.J. Brown, battling with Tyreek Hill, and then Jonathan Jones. But after that, a lot of questions. Sean Wade, Alex Austin, right? Isaiah Bolden, Marcus Jones. Like, you just don't have a lot of corners after the top two guys. So I think this is a really nice pick as well, especially considering it's a need. By the way, he already met Kendrick Bourne. He was at a hibachi place in Foxborough, he said, when he came for his visit, and he met Kendrick Bourne when he was there, which doesn't surprise me at all. Kendrick Bourne's like a super outgoing guy. So I like that. You definitely needed a corner. So I like that more than the other two picks or the offensive line picks, but I like this too. I think this is a smart idea. And then they took Joe Milton, 193rd. If you're not familiar with his work, this guy has an absolute cannon of an arm. He's also a massive human being, 6'5", almost 250 pounds. So you think eventually, right, he makes a position change. I know a lot of people have compared him to, I think it was Dane Brugler compared him to Logan Thomas. He used to play quarterback at Virginia Tech, converted to tight end at the NFL level. I actually was living in Virginia at the time that Logan Thomas was the quarterback there. People thought at one point, like going into his final season, he could be a first-round pick. Obviously, it didn't work out that way. But anyway, I digress. With Milton, I think it's interesting because you think about the Patriots quarterback room. Well, Jacoby Brissett's on a one-year contract. He's obviously not going to be the starter of the team without question in 2025. Like, we don't know when Drake May is going to take the job from Brissett. Brissett very easily could start the year. We've talked about this, could very easily start the year as the quarterback if they feel like, hey, we want to work on some stuff with Drake May. But after that, Drake May is going to be the quarterback for the foreseeable future. Jacoby Brissett may not be back the following season. And then you think about a guy like Bailey Zappe. His contract is going to be up after this year. So, by the way, it is kind of funny, like, juxtaposing the quarterback rooms. Drake May has an absolute cannon. Milton has a cannon. Last year, you had Mack and Bailey Zappe, like, two of the weakest arms in the NFL. Now you have these two guys. So, they're going to need depth at the position. So, like, I understand this. I mean, you could say, hey, maybe they should have gone for a different need. But, hey, if he ends up being a tight end, maybe this is, like, one of your tight ends of the future as well. I mean, Belichick used to do this with quarterbacks. Remember, of course, Julian Edelman was a quarterback at the collegiate level. Jacoby Myers used to play some quarterback back in the day as well. So the one thing that I'll look at for, and by the way, Jamie mentioned this the other day from Callahan's article, his number one attribute, Elliot Wolf, for the quarterbacks was the arm talent. And you have the arm talent with these two guys, certainly, especially the guy that's actually going to play in Drake May. So I liked a lot of what the Patriots did. I know that I was nitpicking a little bit there with some of the lineman stuff, but I you're obviously concerned about who's going to be the left tackle for the Patriots. Is it going to be Okorafor? That's what it feels like it's going to be to start the season. So we'll see how it all winds out with these guys in the future, but I love what they did in terms of attacking the offensive side of the football, getting now the most important investment you've made in the organization, Drake May, get him help, give him receivers. So I really did like that. I love the poke pick, and I love the Baker. I'm, like, falling in love with Baker already. Like, this guy is going to be entertaining. And by the way, he was working out with Drake May for a while, where he was obviously going to Alabama, started at Alabama. Drake May was going to go to Alabama. So those guys were working out together. They know each other. He said that he's the best quarterback in the draft. I mean, obviously, he's not going to. He probably does believe it, but even if he didn't believe it, he wasn't going to say, yeah, I think he's the number two quarterback. But he's the one that said it, loves Drake May. And he was working out with Polk as well. He had been working out with Polk because whatever their workout plan was, I'm sure they're working out with some receiver guru or something along those lines. As long as it's not the guy that represented Nikhil Harry, the footwork guru, that guy. That guy's a snake oil salesman. I mean, he didn't help Nikhil Harry at all. But anyway, I like the draft. I think a lot of you guys are going to come away with the same conclusion that, hey, they needed receivers. They got receivers, right? They needed that for Drake May. I liked it. I do. I like it. All right. Coming up next, we'll bring in producer extraordinaire Jamie McClellan.
This episode is brought to you by Vuori. I love sports. I know you do too. I also know that lots of you exercise, but if you're like me and my wife, the beloved sports gal, you're sick and tired of ugly, uncomfortable workout gear. Especially, I do a lot of walking. I walk around LA. I make calls. I listen to podcasts. Here are two words that will change everything. Vuori clothing, a line of activewear that is unbelievable. The best thing about Vuori is you can lounge around in it. You can work out in it. You can go outside. You can go shopping down your local wherever. And you never feel like you're either underdressed or overdressed. You're just comfortable. You can wear it when you're training, traveling, lounging around the house. Go get yourself some of the most comfortable and versatile clothing on the planet. Here's the deal. Our listeners get 20% off their first purchase at Vuori.com/Simmons. Once again, Vuori.com/Simmons.
This episode is brought to you by Hotels.com. I was traveling internationally last year. I was in Mallorca. I didn't know the island well. I said, let me head to the north, head towards the water. Let me go on Hotels.com and see what they have available. Something preferably on the beach, maybe even a gym. Not only did I get those things, there was a kids session with exercise, gymnastics in the water, pony rides, a train. It had everything, and I didn't even want any of those things. But at least I knew they were there, just in case I changed my mind. And now finding the perfect hotel has never been easier, thanks to the Hotels.com app. Whether you're looking for a family-friendly, right, all-inclusive, or a relaxing spa weekend, you can find exactly what you need and compare hotel prices, ratings, and amenities side by side. So start planning your next getaway and find your perfect somewhere in the Hotels.com app.
Welcome back into Off the Pike. Joining us now, it is producer extraordinaire Jamie McClellan. Jamie, what's going on, man? How are you?
I'm great, Brian. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, man. I'm doing well. Busy day. So, by the way, I was just talking about the draft. I should mention that I mentioned how Joe Milton could be a future tight end for the Patriots because of his size. They did actually draft a tight end in the seventh round. Jaheim Bell from Florida State, 39 receptions, 503 yards. Freaky athlete, 88th percentile in terms of the 40 for a tight end, 4.61, broad 91st percentile. So you get another tight end there too. We'll see what ends up happening with Milton. So I like to pick. They needed a tight end. We'll see how he works out. I mean, he's a seventh round pick, so who the hell knows? But I do like the idea of getting an athletic tight end, a freak show, if you will. I like that. The one thing that I forgot to mention too with Joe Milton earlier, do you realize that was the Mac pick?
That's what they traded with the Jaguars?
Yeah. They traded Mac for Joe Milton.
We'll have to see how their careers pan out. My money might be on Milton. We'll see.
You think Milton could have a better career?
I mean, honestly, maybe.
Yeah. No, I throw it farther. Dude, I don't doubt it. I don't doubt it. Because Milton's also got the chance to be, like, as we mentioned, a tight end possibly down the road because he's an absolute beast of a man. It's an absolute beast, man.
A lot of QBs. You think Bailey Zappi's on his way out?
Yeah, I think eventually. He'll probably be on the team this year, but again, who knows? I mean, you're going to keep
Milton on the practice squad?
They still got Rourke, too.
But, like, who do you think they're carrying in their QB room? All four of them?
No. Well, maybe Zappi gets traded or cut during training camp.
Not even sure it's worth having one of your practice squad positions to be a quarterback either if you already have three.
Yeah, no offense to Zappi, like, I like him, obviously. I think he gave this team a spark 2 years ago. This past season, not as much, but yeah. It's gonna be like crazy seeing Zappi out there with Drake May and Milton. Like crazy. Both guys are crazy athletes. They're huge men, unlike Zappi, and they both have massive arms. And then there's Zappi, who has a relatively weak arm and isn't very athletic. It's going to be kind of weird watching those guys.
Yeah, I guess you couldn't expect Mac to be so bad last year, but in hindsight, I mean, that was such a weak quarterback position. I mean, the fact that I was clamoring for Bailey Zappi is just insane. That's never going to happen again, I don't think.
Well, I mean, it was justified, though. It was justified.
It was. Everything's
based
relative.
On the guy that was playing, right? So anyway, Jamie, you heard my thoughts on the draft. I was pretty satisfied. Yeah. I thought that Elliot Wolf first draft, I thought he did an outstanding job. Now, a lot of that is, hey, you're gifted the third pick, right? But I liked the way that he reacted getting multiple receivers. What'd you make of the draft?
I thought it was interesting seeing someone else under the helm other than Belichick in the sense that, I mean, how many times have we looked at the draft? So we need X, Y, and Z. they do A, B, and C. They do the complete opposite. This year it was quarterback, wide receiver, you know, receivers in general, and offensive line. And then what do you know? They go and do that. So that was kind of refreshing. I mean, it's nice to have that matchup.
Right. And the other thing that you look at, too, is he said after when he was doing his post-draft press conference, if you will, is he mentioned they asked him about taking so many offensive players. He's like, well, we feel pretty good, to paraphrase, we feel pretty good about the defense. We have a lot of good players over there, right? If you think about it, they took, what, one defensive player?
Yeah, cornerback, right?
The corner, that's it. Like, think about that for a second. They went basically all offense. Now, this happened a couple of years ago. Carolina did this 1 year where they took basically all defensive players.
Yeah.
But this is what they needed. Like, they don't need their defense, the one need they had is like another corner, and they did that. And
they got it.
Yeah, they got another corner, but offensively, they needed a lot of stuff, and they need a lot of weapons. So I liked what Elliott Wolf said. I mean, he did like, and the other thing that I would say is this, we sort of, I keep saying tonight, another thing, but anyway, that's, I digress again, but remember after he said, I'm going to weaponize the offense, and we all thought, we all were saying, oh, this is a joke after they go, nobody in free agency? Give him credit. Like, he actually did weaponize the offense, right? I mean, you think about the guys they picked up, and they're not guarantees, but he stuck to his word, and he did upgrade the offense. He did. Like, even though it wasn't Calvin Ridley, and I alluded to it earlier, I was not upset. I mentioned multiple times I was not upset that they didn't get Calvin Ridley, but he put resources, real draft capital, a second and a fourth into receivers. He actually did it. So we're all mocking him when he said we're going to weaponize the offense because they hadn't done shit. They actually did stuff. They actually did stuff. I give him credit.
Yeah, and I think, what was it? I think the first 15 to 20 picks were all on offense just across the entire league. It's just where football is these days. You need an explosive offense, and it felt like the Patriots didn't get the memo the past few years. And like, a great defense can only take you so far, and obviously it's important, but if you have to have a great offense or a great defense, I'd take the great offense. So I'm glad they're investing in that side of the ball. I think it's essential. So yeah, this should be fun. Yeah, I'm glad they double-dipped at receiver as well. That was good.
For sure. So Jamie, before we go, we'll each give our favorite non-Drake May pick, because Drake May's the obvious. Obviously, that's our favorite pick. They got the quarterback of the future. So you want to go first or you want me to?
I think I know who you're going with, so I'll let you go first.
Okay. Mine's pretty obvious. It's Jevon Baker for so many reasons, right? Because I think he can be a stud. I think there's a lot of upside there. But the personality is already electric. Unbelievable.
I wonder, it's an electric personality. The Bill Belichick in me thinks, I wonder if this is going to get him into trouble. But for now, I'm enjoying it. It's definitely amusing. He's an exciting player, too. Like, he's a big guy, makes contested catches. Maybe everything we thought we were getting with Devontae Parker. So I'm excited for that. I think for me, the most intriguing position is definitely Joe Milton. I mean, I was just like looking at him like, holy shit, who the hell is this guy? He just looks... He looks like a stud. He looks the part. Like, he could go out and play on Sundays. So, I mean, I hope they keep him at quarterback if they move him to tight end. I hear he's not, like, a complete burner, but I'm sure he can block a guy. He's 6'5", 250 pounds.
You know what I mean? Yeah. He's a moose. So, yeah, he could certainly. He's a huge dude.
Yeah,
he just seems like he can do a lot. 250? Yeah, that to me was a very intriguing pick as well. But Baker is going to be awesome. I can't imagine if that was Bill that was drafting him when he saw that IG post.
Yeah.
Because remember Gronk got in trouble for going nuts on the stage when they had the helmets on. They were jumping up and down. Now this guy. Oh, man. By the way, I was rewinding the thing I talked about earlier with the Celtics, the post-game press conference, and the guy said death taxes and a spicy series between the Celtics and the Heat. I rewound that like four times. I'm not kidding. I thought it was the guy that was so embarrassing. I just thought it was so awkward. I'm like, why would you ask that? Or why would you say that? Why would you preface your question that way? Just ask the fucking question.
It's swing and a miss in terms of the joke, but they are often spicy series. All jokes aside, they are quite spicy.
For sure. They are spicy, but I don't know why you have to just ask your question. I did find it funny, too, like right before it went from the game before New Orleans and OKC, Reggie Miller said he was dead serious. And he said to Kevin Harlan, you don't think they're going to hit 23 threes again, do you? Harlan's like, no, I don't.
Probably not, Reggie. You're missing Reggie a little on the Celtics broadcast, aren't you?
Well, I mean, I will say, like, I do... When they're winning, I like having them on because it's like entertaining to me. When they're losing, I get pissed. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Something to keep an eye on for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. All right, Jamie. Good stuff, man. Get some sleep.
Thanks, Brian. You too.
All right. As always, make sure to get your voicemails in 617-396-7172. Email your thoughts and questions to offthepike@gmail.com. Thanks to Jamie McClellan and Steve Cerruti for producing this podcast, and we'll chat in a couple of days. Must be 21 plus, 18 plus in DC, and present in select states. FanDuel is offering online sports wagering in Kansas under an agreement with Kansas Star Casino, LLC. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or visit FanDuel.com/RG in Colorado, D.C., Iowa, Michigan, New Jersey, North Carolina, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Illinois, Kentucky, Tennessee, Virginia, and Vermont. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP or text NEXTSTEP to 53342 in Arizona, 1-888-789-7777, or visit ccpg.org/chat in Connecticut. 1-800-9-WITH-IT in Indiana, 1-800-522-4700, or visit ksgamblinghelp.com in Kansas, 1-877-770-STOP in Louisiana. Visit mdgamblinghelp.org in Maryland, visit 1800gambler.net in West Virginia, or call 1-800-522-4700 in Wyoming. Hope is here. Visit gamblinghelplinema.org or call 800-327-5050 for 24/7 support in Massachusetts. Call 1-877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY in New York.
This episode is brought to you by 20th Century Studios' Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. As a ruthless king builds his empire at the expense of the remaining human race, a young ape will fight for the future of apes and humans alike. Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Enter the kingdom in IMAX on May 10th and in theaters everywhere. Get tickets now.